Niggas be looking mad fragile. Yeah, I mean, listen, you can't pull up, be fragile, nigga. Pull up with the fucker, pull up with a stick.
Listen, right, reselling it for everyone. Shout out to Dano, you know what I'm saying? Like, niggas gotta, you gotta be a little, you gotta be thorough with your hustle, you know, in these streets, baby. Can't be some mark off the porch.
Nah, man.
You gotta bang your steel.
You know what I'm saying?
Regulators, ride up.
The Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast. Your favorite sneaker podcast's favorite sneaker podcast. Welcome to episode 26 of the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast. I am your host, Sock Jig. You can follow me on Twitter at Sock Jig and on Instagram as well. Several topics on the podcast today. At the top, I talk about this podcast itself. I call it the state of the podcast and about what kind of my vision is for the rest of the year and kind of the things that what's going well, what didn't go well, and what I want to improve on. I give my version of my top 10 sneakers of 2021. It's a little bit late. It's because I had cut the segment from the last podcast. I talk about grails and paying the mental tax. And then I talk about recent news items with the Louis Vuitton Nike Air Force One and StockX NFTs. And then at the last segment, I talk a bit about how I'm trying to reduce my sneaker collection and kind of the sorting process and how that's been going. So, fun show, might be a little bit longer than usual. I go on a couple tangents, as you'll see. But before all that, we'll talk about pickups and what's been on feet lately. On feet lately has been the Jordan 1 Bred Low from 2016 or so, with the larger swoosh. Also, the Salehe Waterby the Guide shoe, still a super comfortable shoe. I still bring that one in, and also the orange Peace Be the Journey pair as well too. Pickups, it's been pretty light. I picked up a pair of the Supreme Air Force One Wheats. A friend helped me out on those. Thank you very much. And, you know, I'm still not sure if I'm really a Wheat Air Force One guy or not. I guess I gotta get olive pants or something like that. I don't have olive pants. I also picked up a pair of John Elliott Edition One Runner in white, which I got for like 50% off. So those are actually pretty fire in hand. They're super nice quality. It's not exactly the perfect weather to wear those now, so I haven't worn them, and I'll probably pull them out in the spring. In terms of skips and misses, it's been a light January. There hasn't been anything. The Red Thunder, I tried for those half asleep in bed. I just tried on livestock, and, you know, when you're half asleep in bed and you're refreshing the new arrivals page, you know, I have most of my monitors and stuff like that turned off, so I'm just going 100% manual. You really do see how hard it is. Whatever, those weren't a must. Really, I was just trying to see what villas were available to rent in Tuscany, to make a Seinfeld reference there. All right, since it's a new year, I wanted to give a little bit of a state of the podcast address. My next podcast will most likely be the annual State of the Sneaker Game kind of show that I do, where I give an overview of where we're at in terms of buying, selling, botting, resell retailers and sneaker brands. My goal was always to tie that with the presidential State of the Union address. And usually it's always like late January, but I guess it's in early March this time. But briefly here, I want to talk about this podcast itself. I heard a stat that 95% of podcasts have fewer than 500 listeners. You know, and that's like, you know, every podcast in the world. So, you know, technically I'm top 5% in the world, baby. So thank you for listening. In terms of podcasts, you know, I think people mostly listen for the topic and specifically for the host or for the guest. So in my case, since I don't really have guests very often, I'm assuming you are listening to me because you follow me on Twitter and kind of know my voice from Twitter. You know, I'm not sure there's anyone that's just randomly searching, you know, sneaker podcast on Spotify and is finding the show and enjoying it. So really, that's how I've treated this podcast as not the main thing. I've always treated it as an extension of the Twitter account and kind of a more of a long form director's commentary, as I've said before. You know, when I started, I thought it would actually be pretty easy. I thought you just, you know, plug in the mic, talk for 30 minutes, press record, and then send it out. And it's actually not that easy at all. I have to go back and edit it, take out all the ums and things like that I'm saying. But even before that, I'm usually like in my notes app and I have a bunch of ideas of what I want to talk about. And I kind of make a point form list. One of the harder things has been figuring out how to translate, you know, the jokes and stuff that I do on Twitter into podcast form where I'm talking alone into a mic. And it's pretty hard to do. You know, memes and stuff like that are just easier to do on Twitter or Instagram or whatever when you're reacting to something. Whereas on a podcast, you know, recording alone, jokes work out better as, you know, a short segment or just a line here or there. You know, I did a Take Quake podcast where it was all kind of outrageous sneaker takes and jokes. And that was probably one of my least listened to podcasts. But really, I had a blast doing that one and I was at least making myself laugh. So I just assume that someone else listening has the same sense of humor. But as I said, I know it's not going to be for everyone and this is all still kind of a work in progress. In terms of making money from the show and stuff, I've always said it's important to do that, but I've never had a desire to seek out advertisers or things like that. I just figured I'd do socks once a month and honestly, that's worked out way better than I ever thought. You guys always support me. So as I say, that's the best way to support me. If you see me releasing socks and they interest you, you know, that keeps the show going, that keeps my interest going. That makes it all kind of worth it. And if not, you know, I know it's not going to be, as I've said before, I know it's not going to be for everyone. So the Twitter is free. The podcast is free. You know, retweets are free. So you can always support that way as well, too. I just think it's a better way to go instead of doing, you know, live ad reads for, you know, penis pills or mattresses. And instead, just kind of promoting your own self. By the way, thank you for everyone who bought the Iris Moon Blue socks. I do have a new pair of socks coming, dropping probably early February, and I've been dropping some teasers on Twitter for it. They're called the Business Plan. It's something totally different than what I've done. And when you do that, there's a risk that it might be a dud and it might fail, but that's, you know, also the fun part. A small sidebar tangent on promoting yourself. I'm always a firm believer that if you got something to plug for something that you created or wrote or just worked on, you should promote yourself proudly. Look, here's something I did, here's what it is, here's a preview of it, please check it out. Never be like, oh, here's a stupid thing I did, lol. You know, never talk down on the thing that you just worked on and created and you want people to check out. You know, Chris Rock has this bit about, you know, talking to women with confidence. Yeah, you know, excuse me, I was wondering, ma'am, I have a request. Could you, you know, lick my bleep? And she responds, I ain't licking nothing. Lick your own bleep. So if you have something to promote, if you're selling something, or you wrote a blog post or whatever it is, say it with confidence. Remove the self-deprecating stuff. Remove the emoji at the end. Remove the LOL. You know, otherwise you got dry bleep. Anyways, back to the podcast. In terms of frequency, monthly is still the one that works the best for me. You know, I've said a few times, I can only work on one thing at a time. So either I'm writing stuff, I've got enough, you know, notes in my notes app for a podcast, so then I start recording it, or, you know, later socks are releasing, so I'm working on, you know, getting that set up and packaging and things like that. You know, I'm not a young content creator living with roommates in a house dedicated to content creation. This is all kind of done in the extra hours that I have, and sometimes those hours are very late at night or early in the morning. I record this podcast usually after midnight when the house is quiet and over a few days. It usually takes me 2 or 3 days. And then the third day is spent editing it down. But with that said, my main goal for the pod this year is to have more episodes with guests. I know I've reached out to a few people and I do have people lined up and who are willing to do it. It's just a problem, as I said, of scheduling a time that works, a time when, you know, the house is silent. But the other part is my goal is to have interviews that are conversational and not exactly, you know, tell me your history. But that still requires work in terms of having topics and directions and kind of letting conversations lead into whatever direction. So just like anything, I might not be good at it at first, but just takes reps. But most of all, thank you for listening. Thank you for making me top 5% in the world. We're best in the world, baby. I should probably stop saying baby. I wanted to talk about my top 10 sneakers of 2021. I'm a little bit late on this because I originally had this in the last podcast, but I cut it out. You know, probably shouldn't be doing top 10 lists after, you know, January 6th, just like you can't say Happy New Year after January 6th. But I was thinking about, you know, top 10 lists and kind of lists that I've seen. You know, there's the curated version of the list that, you know, people like Complex and all these blogs put out, where you're trying to make a list that covers kind of all the brands and all the best of the year and, you know, the politics involved with those publications and how they make those lists. My version of this was just my rankings that I did for the sneaker bracket itself. But when I see, you know, these publications make these lists, you can tell where, you know, they don't want it to be, you know, all Nike or all 100% hype. You want to be able to make statements like, you know, saying the 450 Cloud was one of the best of the year, things like that. From when I saw people sharing their personal top 10 lists or their personal brackets with me with the bracket generator that I made, you know, I saw tons of random sneakers as best of the year, you know, LeBron South Beach 8 or, you know, the 450, as I mentioned. And I get it that, you know, that South Beach 8 was impossible to get the first time it dropped, you know, only at a few of those Foot Locker stores. And now it was actually widely available. So if you were waiting on that shoe for, you know, years and you finally got it, of course, it's going to be your favorite one. And, you know, there's always people that just want to be different. And, you know, I saw Strawberry Coughs and 450 Cloud or it goes the opposite way where, you know, you're just unabashedly hype and you want to say University Blue Ones are the favorite. On these lists, I think it's totally okay to admit that you like all hype. You know, I love GRs. I talk about all the GRs I've bought on the show itself, but they don't need to be in the top 10 at all. The other question is always, do you include shoes that you missed out on? You almost have to because there's no way you know, got everything unless you just paid resale and you're including it on the list. So quickly, my top 10 sneakers. And again, this is just a personal list. I'm not trying to, you know, like I said, look at my sneaker bracket generator to see the top 10 list where I took my favorites and personals out of here. So quickly, number 10 was the Kobe 6 Del Sol. I originally had this sneaker when it first came out. I wore those shoes to the ground, so this is probably the very last Kobe 6 to release, and Kobe 6s are my favorite of all the Kobes, so it was one of those ones. I didn't even get it on retail, like who did, so I just bought it on resale on GOAT. Number 9, the Travis Fragment High, the Jordan 1 High. Yes, I was lucky enough to get the raffle to have these, and honestly, I don't know what to do with them. They go for too much for me to probably undead stock and wear them, which I'll talk about in another segment a little bit later. Once I saw that they were based on, like, you know, an old prototype or PE or whatever it was, it kind of made sense. Number 8, the Trophy Room 1. Obviously, there's a lot of baggage with this shoe, and the release really has tainted the shoe for a lot of people. But the shoe itself, a Chicago with a great story, I thought was really good. And this one too, I have, and I got the blue laces and everything. But as I said, I paid basically a little bit under market price before they released. But see a past podcast where I talk about all about this shoe. Number 7, the Off-White Chicago 2. This is another shoe, you know, I probably didn't have in my top 10 at first, but then it slowly bumped up as I saw, you know, all that came with it, the kind of the rollout with it. And then, of course, with Virgil passing, it changed everything too. Number 6, the Topaz Union 4. This one in size 12 is basically impossible. So I was super thankful I was able to get this one. I did get an assist on this one. So thank you for the person who assisted me on that. Number 5, the Dusty Olive Dunk. I don't have this one. This is one of the ones where I really wanted it, and it's just always been 350 plus on GOAT in my size. There's a bunch of dunks. You can probably replace any of them in this number 5 spot, the medium Curry, and even any of the true be true to your school type of ones, the lows that came out, like the Michigan State, or Georgetown. Those are all pretty solid. I know the quality is probably not the greatest on it, and the quality is probably much nicer on these suede ones like it was in the 2020 dunks. Number 4, the Air Max 1 Pata, the orange pair. I like the blue pair as well. I didn't get those ones. Like I said, I paid a ton of duty on those ones, so I was like, oh, I'll just pick them up on resale. But I think resale has shot up like 50, 60 bucks on these even since then. Number three is the Ama Manier 3. This is a really beautiful shoe. This shoe is literally the only women's shoe that I have because, you know, I'm a size 12 men's. That's a size 13 and a half women's, which they don't ever make. And if they did, like they did with the Off-White Jordan 4s, it's a super rare size. So it's one of those cases where they made a women's shoe that was actually available in, you know, men's sizing and the bigger sizes as well. You know, one of the things I was thinking about is, would this shoe be everyone's number one shoe if it was 100% women's sizing only and only available in women's, you know, size 5 to 9.5 or whatever? I really don't think it would. I think it would be a lot of people upset about it and a lot of people talking shit about it. I think Nike was well aware of that. James Whitner was probably well aware of that. And that's why they made it available in all sizes, in the bigger sizes as well. Number two, my personal favorite that I probably wore the most this year. You can even check my, you know, previous podcast where I even talked about what I was wearing that week, is the Slihy Waterbee The Guide. But it's a super comfortable pair. It's easy to wear. It's a wild color. You know, it stands out when you're wearing black pants or whatever. So that's why I wore it. And number one, my personal favorite sneaker of the year was the Travis Fragment Low. And even this shoe, I did a 180 on. At first, I was like, this is lazy. But, you know, for me, it's a culmination of everything. I probably never get the Fragment ones themselves. So this is as close as I'll get. It's a Travis shoe on top of that. I love Jordan 1 Lows as well. So it was, the quality of them is really good. At least my pair is really good. So my personal favorite of the year. And I do have these and I have worn them. Some other sneakers this year that I really liked. I like the ACG Air Moab Return. And I know people are upset about, you know, the shape and what they changed with it. Honestly, I don't give a shit about that kind of stuff, because once you wear it, the shape is going to get all misshapen anyways. And they added pull tabs, which the OGs never had. But if you've ever put on those shoes, they're a pain in the ass to wear and you need those pull tabs. In terms of super underrated this year, I really like the return of the KoJP Air Force Ones, the Acorn and the 3M Snake. They're probably under retail on GOAT, but I was glad to get some of those early 2000s pairs. Another Air Force One I really liked was the Undefeated 5 on it. That was probably one of the better releases of the year, all the Undefeated ones. Even though a stock was a ton, but it was still a good release. So in terms of best releases of the year, it's probably the Ama Manier 3, the ALD, and the Kith kind of loyalty access. And this probably is Undefeated drops that they did. Other shoes that I like, I really like the Carpet SB Dunk High. I like the Yeezy 700 V2 Cream. I like every Yeezy boot. As I've said on Twitter, Kanye has never missed on a boot. They're all fire. In terms of misses, I missed out on the Panda Dunk. I still can't get that one. The Joe Fresh Goods is another shoe that's probably on a lot of people's top list. I could not get it, and I don't want to pay, you know, $380 or whatever it is for it in my size. The colors look like I just need to see it in hand, and I haven't seen it on hand. I missed out on Lightning 4s. I probably should have tried a little bit harder, and it's also one of those shoes where kind of everyone got and I missed. The University Blue ones, those ones are super nice. I usually try to buy every single Jordan 1 that I can, and this kind of last 2021 or so, I kind of decided I should at least stop doing that. Which I'll talk about a little bit later in my how to reduce your sneaker collection segment. And I missed out on the Off-White Dunks, and I'm okay with that. That, you know, they didn't even drop in Canada, so that's why. So I have the, you know, the Pine Green, the first Off-White Dunks that came out, so that's good enough for me. I was recently profiled by Sneaker Admirals. Check them out on Twitter at Sneaker Admirals. And in the profile they asked, what are my grails? And I said that my grail has always been the Bred 1 Jordan 1, which I got in 2016 itself. So I know that's not what people might consider a grail, but that was the shoe that I wanted, I couldn't find, I couldn't get. And especially pre-2016, it wasn't like how it is now. There was no easy way to get StockX. You were really concerned about, you know, getting fakes, especially on eBay for myself as well. I just didn't want to deal with eBay. The other shoe that I've always wanted, the one that I don't actually have, is the White Cement 3s, and I mentioned in that profile as well. When the 88 White Cement 3s with the Nike Air on the back, you know, dropped in 2013 or whatever it was, that was one of the most fake shoes around, especially on Facebook back in the day. I just completely stayed away, and it's one of those ones that I've always wanted ever since I saw, you know, Jordan dunking from the free throw line. I probably mentioned it on the podcast before, and I do have the free throw line version, which has a Nike Air in the back and has the red line at the bottom, but I would still like the Nike Air version. And I do have, you know, the Jumpman version that came in, you know, 2012 or whatever it was. The one where all the paint is cracking on the midsole. But what I said in that profile was, I don't feel the need to always be chasing something unattainable. And that, you know, there's lots of expensive shoes that I, you know, I'd love to get, but I'm just kind of happy with what I have. Sure, there's lots of expensive shoes that I have that I have worn and some that I haven't. You know, I've talked about my Mars Yards that I've had, which I bought when they were $700 and wore right away. But if I had them dead stock right now, I don't think I'd wear them. I would probably just hold on to them, just like, you know, those Travis Fragment Highs. Or I was trying to say, I hope, you know, you can feel this way about your collection one day and not feel the need to constantly chase the next one. And I know as sneakerheads, we kind of do that all the time. What's releasing? What do I want to get? You know, the Jordan Spring 2022 collection has dropped. What on there looks good? Also, you know, what's realistic for you? For me, it's always been, you know, it was, the line was 300 US, then it was 500 US, then it was, you know, 700 US. I probably could have had, you know, off-white Jordan 1 Chicago 1s when they were 1100 in my size, but my limit was spending 700 US at the time. But those shoes are worth 5,000 now, so. What I've said to people before, if there's something that you really want and it is within your range, maybe it's, you know, your spending limit is $600 and the shoes themselves are $1,000. I always say don't pay the mental tax. If you subtract the difference of the $400 or $500 and you amortize that difference over the amount of time you've been spent thinking about it, you're paying monthly rent on that sneaker that you don't have. You're paying $15, $20 a month, whatever it is, just thinking about it all the time. I have a friend who wanted the Atmos Air Max ones, the elephant print ones, and I'd always tell him, you should just get it because it's not like the price is ever going to go down. You know, at the time, they were probably selling for 700 US or so, which I know is a lot. You know, for me, I've at least come to the point where my spending limit is, like I said, 1,000, but for someone who doesn't buy as many sneakers as I do, spending $500 on a resale site is probably a ton. And that's just, you know, you have to make that decision with something that's an ultra classic shoe that's never going to go down. It just restocked in 2017, so I don't think it's going to restock for another 20 years like the last time. So finally, I think he was able to find a pair from Gusto the Ninja on Instagram for, you know, a worn once or twice pair for a pretty good price. And I kind of probably helped push him over the edge with my talk about it. You know, he messaged me one day and he was like, what should I do? I was like, you got to take it. And he did, and he's super happy with it. And, you know, he's got his grails, he wears them, he loves them. So I'm saying, be happy with what you have. The ones that got away, let them go away. If they're within range, don't pay the mental tax. That's how I approach all this kind of stuff. So on the topic of grails, let's talk about the Louis Vuitton Air Force One that are releasing soon. So from what we know so far, there's been 200 monogram pairs that are exclusive for a Sotheby's auction, where the proceeds go to a charity or a scholarship fund or something like that. And there's also friends and family exclusive colors that are releasing, in yellow, orange, purple, and blue, and I think red as well too. And those are going out to, you know, Don C and DJ Khaled, as you've probably seen. From everything else, they've said that there is going to be a regular retail release as well at Louis Vuitton stores. But from what I've heard, and I've been hearing in the last, like, you know, few months, is that you're not going to get access, and mostly it's probably already been allocated that it's for the big spenders only, the 100,000 and more annual spenders. if you spend $50K a year at Louis Vuitton, I don't even know how many items that is. That might only be like 4 items. You're not going to get access. And when this news came out, you know, you see the response vary all over the place, especially on Twitter. The one that always cracks me up is, man, this sucks that I can't buy this. And just like I said previously about Grails, you got to come to acceptance sometimes, even before a sneaker has released, that it's just not for you. That this is just a ultra-rich hype project that they've made. There's not going to be 80,000 pairs dropping on sneakers. So you shouldn't treat it like you do, you know, Red Thunder 4s or something like that. You know, the other responses are, you know, people who are super hyped on it, of course, or the ones that just think that they suck because they look like bootlegs. And, you know, obviously that's kind of the point of the shoe. Honestly, these shoes don't really do much for me. You know, I know they were inspired by bootlegs and, you know, the Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock wore them on the It Takes Two album cover, and that is, you know, totally my era. And those are probably done by, you know, Dapper Don and all the stuff that he was, you know, creating in that era. So as I said, even though I'm of the era, they're just not for me. I feel nothing about them. Yeah, I'm totally okay with that. You know, I said, as forever Mr. Brightside, I said, your best bet is to pretend they don't exist. Because the only people who will probably get these shoes are the crypto bros who, you know, can flip a monkey and buy the shoe. If you have a shoe that's worth $4,000, like the Travis Fragment ones that I've talked about, would you wear that shoe? You know, I could totally see myself wearing that shoe. I've got Mars Yards and they're worth probably, you know, in that range, and I've worn them. I could totally undead stock a $4,000 shoe. But myself, personally, I could not undead stock a $10,000 shoe like the Dior Jordan ones. But someone listening would probably say I would totally do that and not flip them. But shoes worth, you know, a sizable mortgage down payment, $30,000, $40,000, would you wear $30,000, $40,000 shoes? Hey, come on, you know, ask yourself, would you really do that? And that's why I said the NFT people who have cashed out and all of a sudden flush with money are probably the ones who are going to make that decision. Because what is it to them? It's just a JPEG to them. So say the LV, you know, had a lottery and randomly you, this non-VIP spender, was able to get them. And really, if you had these shoes, they would probably be a huge headache. Here, let me do a Mr. Brightside for this. If you had these shoes and you waffled on, you know, trying to wear them and not sell them, your wife may be very much like Fat Tony's wife on The Simpsons, who was most vocal on the subject of the pretzel monies. Where's the money? When are you going to get the money? Why aren't you getting the money now? And so on. So as a Mr. Brightside, don't get divorced over some Louis Vuitton sneakers. But that's all just like fantasy talk, as if, you know, we talk about when you buy a lotto ticket. What am I going to do with the money? You're not going to win the lotto and you're not going to get these shoes. So accept it. It's totally fine. And as I was talking about on Twitter, if you really want these shoes and you know how, you should totally make your own. These shoes are inspired by bootleg. Nike's gone out of their way to kind of get customizers out of the game now. And now they're kind of releasing shoes inspired by the game of customization. So Virgil would have totally approved. He approved of the kicks that Armenian Kicks made, the blue MoMA ones. And I think that he just, you know, bought Air Force One, white Air Force Ones and some paint from Home Depot and kind of slapped it together. And it was supposed to be just, you know, a viral joke kind of thing, but Virgil loved it. He thought it was awesome. And because Virgil was all about free game, and that's what, you know, the whole Off-White brand was supposed to be, this kind of in-between thing. So if I knew how to do all of this stuff, which I don't at all, I would totally do it. I would get in a white Air Force One. I would get, you know, the orange paint or the red paint or whatever. I would get, if I had access to a 3D printer, I would get that stamp or embosser for the LV stuff. Make my own. So if you're listening and you know how, if you want to go viral, go ahead, make your own. All right, next topic, StockX NFTs. In my standard disclaimer about NFTs, I don't have any. I don't know a ton about them. I know a little bit about them, as I've talked about on this show itself. And as I've said, I'm not against the premise of digital assets. I think that's the part where people get upset, where, oh, you just don't get it. I totally understand, and I can see a future where it has more utility than it does right now. So StockX debuted their version of NFTs, and how they pitch it is it's connecting NFTs to a popular sneaker that's sitting on a shelf in their vault, you know, tied via, you know, one-to-one on the blockchain, which they call a vault NFT. If you buy the vault NFT, you are the owner of not only the physical good, but also of a token that represents that physical product on that shelf. And you can sell that token, flip it with ease, as they would say, and no shipping costs. And they also pitch that you, you know, will get access to rewards. Anytime I see you get access to rewards, I think, oh, you're going to get some t-shirts or tracksuits or something. And how they say it is you can invest in culture like never before. Some other notable things I saw when I was going through the site, it's mostly sneakers that are size 10. It was available for U.S. billing addresses only. And how they're doing the additions is per mint. I guess there's additions per mint using some multi-token thing. Again, I'm not an expert on this NFT stuff. So if I'm wrong about any of this stuff, let me know and I'll pretend to listen. In terms of the NFTs themselves, it looked like they made their version of NFTs on top of the kind of existing version that people are aware of. It looks like it's, you know, it's still minted on Ethereum, blockchain, and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, how it's different, of course, is it's not 100% digital, you know, aka non-fungible. It's tied to a product, and you can't transfer to another wallet because technically you don't own it. That's the other thing. Because they have this kind of divide, what they're saying is StockX is the one who really owns the NFT, and you kind of have access to it on our marketplace. And that's how they kind of tie it to their own marketplace instead of on any other marketplace. And that's whatever the dream of, you know, decentralization with these NFT dudes always talk about. But really, they don't. No one really cares about that kind of stuff. They just pretend they do. Making money is what, you know, people in this world really care about. So, you know, StockX has this simplified version of NFTs, and I think they did that so that they could reach a wider audience, and they tied it to a physical product, so it kind of makes sense. You know, as I was doing this, there's another tangent I wanted to go on, another sidebar. There was this Nike designer that quit a little while ago, and it was like two or three of them that quit Nike, and one of them gave a statement to Complex because he was leaving to go work on NFTs, and I guess he was already an NFT artist in that world. And he said something like, his name is Chad Knight, and he said, "I want to help create the future that has an opportunity at Nike, given that the old guard's lack of interest in ideas that aren't their own." And he goes on to say, "Unfortunately, you cannot have ideas about subject matter unless you possess knowledge of it." Taking a direct shot at Nike that they don't know anything about NFTs and that kind of stuff. And really, like, weeks later, they, you know, invested or bought out that Artifact Studios. And I think on the last podcast, I called it RTFKT. So that shows you how much of this world that I know about. But anyways, I was thinking about that. And what I wanted to say is, if you are leaving a job, making statements in an exit interview is a bad idea and can only hurt you. It has absolutely no benefit to you, no help. It could only hurt you. So say you're wanting to quit a job and you give your notice and they want to do an exit interview and you didn't like that place and you want to go in there and tell them off. Tell them why you're leaving, what's wrong with the place, what the failures were, because it'll just feel so good to kind of let it all out. But guess what? The person listening is not going to listen. They're not going to care. Human nature will kick in. They will get defensive and they will say, "Who the fuck is this guy? Why is he saying this shit to me? Get the hell out of here." Whatever ideas and battle plan that you give them on this exit interview, they will just simply ignore. If they didn't implement your ideas when you were there, they're not going to do it now when you're on your way out. So if anything, they will now work to badmouth you to your network. And in most job networks, it's usually a pretty small world. Like if you're in the tech industry in Austin, Texas or something, most of those people probably know each other there. So this guy who left Nike, you know, said some shit about Nike. They don't know what they're doing. 2 weeks later, they're now huge into this by buying out Artifact Studios. And say that studio was looking for a new artist to work on this big Nike project. Guess who they're not going to call? This designer guy. So if you are ever leaving a job and there's an exit interview, say absolutely nothing. It might be very hard to do and not very satisfying, but just say you're leaving for a new opportunity. That's it. Repeat over and over, leaving for a good opportunity. You know, maybe this has been secretly a business podcast all along. Anyways, back to StockX NFTs. The other thing is about legality and how they're doing this. So can StockX do this without Nike or Adidas' consent? You know, the more I thought about it, I think they possibly can. You know, I had some jokes on Twitter about how do you sue in the metaverse? Like, are you going to get your lawyer to put his digital Jeff Staples sneakers on and serve papers in the metaverse? But really, from what you can see, it's pushing, IP, intellectual property laws to their absolute boundaries. I said on Twitter, I think StockX survives any potential lawsuits because of that, that physical product. I said in finance terms, it's a derivative, which is a contract between parties whose value is based on an underlying financial asset. And, a stock option is a derivative. You know, on this case, the contract just happens to be on the blockchain. And I know there's laws there about who has the right to make a derivative and not. Usually it's still the owner of the financial asset. That's why they say, StockX says, you actually own the physical shoe and the shoe itself is a financial asset. So this is also why they didn't go 100% digital NFT. If there was no shoe on a shelf, they couldn't sell pictures of Chunky Dunks. If StockX did 100% digital NFTs, what would it be? It'd be pics of, Josh Luber wearing a backwards hat or wearing a Bape hoodie that's two sizes too big. Who's going to pay, two Ethereum for that? But really, the way law works, Nike could sue if they feel like it. You can sue anyone for anything. They could say, StockX is capitalizing on our fame. They could say we already have a patent on it and, sue on patent grounds. But I'm assuming StockX lawyers have already vetted all this stuff because that's what lawyers do. And as I said, I would welcome any lawsuits about this stuff because it would force companies to actually explain what they want to do instead of doing all this hand-waving and PR marketing speak that they're doing right now. The other thing was StockX just basically dropped it as a first-come, first-serve thing with the announcement. And I'm pretty sure that if they do it again, it's going to be pretty hard to get. Because the way bot developers work is they were writing bots right now to automate that. So really, the StockX NFT thing is kind of genius, really. I think they did a really smart thing of tying it to a product on a shelf. Even this kind of in-between stuff that they're doing where it's not exactly decentralized and you can't just sell it on OpenSea. That is because StockX wants to make their money on their marketplace. That's what they, really are. The idea of taking a shoe and putting it on the blockchain and then pulling it out and wearing it and having it just kind of disappear on the blockchain is pretty cool. I think showing this ownership trail is actually pretty interesting. Imagine Nike releasing a bunch of NFTs that Jordan owned. And then, DJ Khaled and then the Reddit guy bought it for his wife, Serena Williams. It's totally like George Costanza buying John Voight's car. And on the other side, why it's dumb, it's dumb for the same reason all NFTs are dumb. If it's not for you, if it doesn't make any sense, then just leave it be. Just, let it be a thing for people who are totally into it. If you want to invest in culture by buying a shoe, buy the shoe. If you can do this right now on Goat Storage and not even have ownership, physical ownership of it, you can still, buy the Chunky Dunk and have it put on Goat's shelf. You just can't sell that idea that you own it to someone else. And that's where I see, the utility of this, where if the NFT price kind of came closer to what the market price of the shoe is, but had a value add of $100 or $200 or whatever, I would totally jump in then. And it was easy to buy, easy to do, because I totally love the idea of Goat Storage and buying shoes and investing in a shoe that I think is going to go up and then selling it later. But right now, a Panda Dunk on Goat is $330 in my size, but the NFT of the same shoe is, $1,400. So there's a discrepancy there. Right now, I just leave it for the crypto bros to do whatever they do. The other thing that people will say about this is this lamenting of sneakers as an asset class and where it's going and how far it's drifting from what it was. There's this great song by a band called LCD Sound System called Losing My Edge. I really recommend you check it out and listen to the song. This song released in, 2003 or so. And the song is totally about the singer James Murphy lamenting how he's losing his edge to the new generation. And he's talking about kind of the music industry and the new generation of people and artists coming up and collectors coming up, music listeners coming up. You know, one of the lines he says is, I'm losing my edge to the art school Brooklynites in little jackets and borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s. Just that line alone connects it directly to sneakers if you wanted to. The whole song does. You know, borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s could be Nike's motto for how close it resembles what they release. Or art school Brooklynites in little jackets, that could be the people lined up outside of ALD right now. So in the song, he laments this kind of new generation, but also rejoices like what he had accomplished. And he says multiple times that he was there. I was the first guy playing Daft Punk to the Rock Kids. And you see this all the time. You want credit for what you've done, what your place in sneakers is, and how you were there. He even says in there, I've never been wrong. And everyone knows someone who has opinions and thoughts about sneakers and things like that and thinks that they've never been wrong. But the key line, one of the key lines in the song, he says, is, I'm losing my edge to better looking people with better ideas and more talent, and they're actually really, really nice. So he's saying, hey, look, this generation, they're coming up, and they're not actually assholes. They're super nice. But at the same time, he's also commenting on them, on what they're doing and what he's done in music. And it could totally tie into sneakers. He has a bunch of lines like, I heard you have a compilation of every good song ever done by anybody. And you could say that about, collectors. And I heard you were able to get any good sneaker ever made. I hear that you and your band sold your guitars and bought turntables. I hear that you and your band have sold your turntables and bought guitars. But then later on he'll say, but have you seen my records? And he starts listing off a bunch of super underground 80s punk bands like Nation of Ulysses or The Germs or Scott Walker. And finally, the song ends with him just repeating over and over, you don't know what you really want. And this song is a perfect encapsulation of this kind of idea in sneakers, that there's a new generation coming in. They're taking things in their own direction. They have borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s, even though you were actually there in the 80s. So when you think about these kind of things along the lines, you totally see, the Russ Bankston types, angry and upset about it and, lamenting where it's going. And I said, I do this podcast because I'm of that generation and I don't feel like that at all. If your motto is the game is the game, then you need a sign that says the game is the game so you can kind of tap that sign whenever this kind of stuff comes up. This is just what happens when money is involved. I may have even mentioned this song on this podcast before, and I know I've said a few of these things before, but I'll say it again and again. Every generation needs their own thing and take things in their own direction. And what's funny is every old person knows this when they're young, but once they get old, they forget it. They can't believe that it's happening. When you mix in money and this asset class stuff, it just makes sense that this would be a natural evolution of where this generation would take it. Because how can you remove money from anything, really? You know what they say about the old days? They're the old days. The had to know someone was just the scarcity model of the time. The scarcity model is kind of everywhere in NFTs and sneakers and all this kind of stuff. And you just don't have to participate. There's no rules that you have to participate. So if this generation is taking a bunch of borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s, mixing in this asset class business and kind of going in this direction of NFTs and tying it back to sneakers somehow, I don't know, put on your Jeff Staple digital sneakers, grab your monkey and take that shit to the moon. Since I've already established that I'm losing my edge, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is reducing my sneaker collection. And so I want to lay out some of the steps and thoughts that I've been going through in the last month and a half or 2 months or so. I probably have 200 shoes close to there. I haven't counted in a while. They're in stacks and all over the place in the house, so that's why it's not exactly easy to count. Every sneakerhead gets to this point where they just get kind of overwhelmed or thinking that they have too much, or they get into a sell-off phase. I've obviously done this in the past before, and I think it's probably a good time to do it again. And one of the things that I do is I don't really let some of my sneakers get too old. I remember 5-6 years ago where I was thinking I got to sell off all of my sneakers older than 2006. So a lot of like the yellowing metallic fives and things like that, I sold off then. So what I'm going to describe is just kind of my first steps in the sell-off, and I will probably update this as a feature, as a segment later on. So obviously the first thing is deciding what to sell. So some stuff is just off limits. Anything, of course, with sentimental value, or for myself, OGs, which ends up being, you know, sentimental value or nostalgia. You know, at one point I wanted to sell a bunch of my off-whites, and I think I sold my black Prestos. And now with Virgil's passing, I want to keep all of them. So also what I'm ignoring for now are all my used pairs. I don't want to go through the hassle of cleaning pairs, taking photos, listing on Goat or eBay. I'm just thinking about some of my new pairs that I haven't worn yet. Also ignoring for now my problem of buying new sneakers and the influx of what's coming in. You know, we'll just kind of, we'll put a box lid on that and worry about that later. So what qualifies are sneakers that I may have bought as investments, shoes that I think would have value later. I always say that this is how I normally resell. I think if a shoe is going to sell later for a higher price, I will buy now and, you know, sell it later. Foam runners are a good example of that. I thought there's value in them. And wintertime might not be the best time to sell them. You know, usually people, I assume, would wear them in the spring or summer. So I might sell a few of those, but keep some of them for spring or summer. So the other thing that you have to look at are sneakers that sell quick. Obviously, like I said, foam runners and dunks and things like that, those are sneakers that would move quick. And the other ones that I'm going to take a look, at least, are sneakers that will take forever to sell. These can be bricks. They can also be just older shoes that no one is currently looking for. Or even some like high priced, super rare shoe might take forever to sell. For example, I have a ALD 997, the one with the pink tongue, which is super rare, especially in my size, but I'm not exactly in the mood to sell it for super cheap. And there's no one really looking to buy it for $2,000 right now, it seems. But in addition, you know, some of these categories, they just kind of present themselves naturally. You're going to have the sneakers that are bricks where you have the total buyer's remorse in buying them. And of course, you probably already have those listed. So that is definitely one pile. Another easy one is the never going to wear pile. Another pile that I'm making is semi-heat. And really, most of the sneakers that I'll probably be selling will be in this category. I figured I would get all these type of sneakers out the door first and then worry later about the heat shoes and some of the ones that you want to keep or don't keep. It's easier to do that on a shoe that sells for $300 than it is for something that is $700. But then again, you might have some shoes that are worth $700 that you don't care for. So if it qualifies, it qualifies. You know, I mentioned sneakers that are going to go out of style soon. This happens for all sneakers. Every sneaker really does have a lifespan. You know, for a shoe like a Jordan 1, it seems like it's endless. And that's why it's such an ultra classic. But, you know, you look at shoes like the Roshe Run. It was huge and it came and it's gone. The Ultra Boost is, of course, the other one. There was a time and a place to sell off your Ultra Boost that you probably could have done well. It's just a matter of recognizing when that is going to be. For example, you know, Sakai, in my opinion, are probably going to go out of style soon enough. I know they're still coming out, and the ones recently haven't been as nice. That's always a good sign. Acronym Prestos is another example. Those are kind of almost forgotten now, especially when the second set that came out wasn't as nice as the first three. And that's another good place to find shoes to sell off is if you have a set, let's say those Acronym Prestos, the three that came from the first drop. Of those three, there's probably one pair that you would probably naturally go to and wear first. If you do, you can kind of safely sell the other two because that is really the one go-to. So obviously I mentioned it there, the wearing it, of course, is the main category. Is this a sneaker that I'm going to wear? Do I see myself wearing it anytime soon? Does it match my current style right now? You know, for example, some highs are super harder to wear than low cuts, especially the older you get. how comfortable is it? Is of course the other one. You know, I bought these Raging Bull 5s and because I never got them the first time they came out, and I got them now, and they don't sell for that much either. And now I'm looking at this shoe where it's like, did I really want this shoe? Because it is super bulky, it is super red, and super hard to wear. So right now I'm just dealing with the fact that I bought this shoe and have the shoe, and I should probably put it on the sell pile, and not dealing with the fact that why I bought it in the first place. Serenity now. You know, the other method of doing this is the Marie Kondo Netflix show one, where she says, you know, does it bring you joy? You got to open the sneakers, take a look at them, hold them in hand, put them on feet, you know, on carpet or whatever, and ask yourself, does it bring me joy? And if it does, you put it in the keep pile. Otherwise, you put it in the sell pile. So as I mentioned, I do have all these sneakers, and set aside the ones that I wanted to get rid of for now. And I physically put them all in stacks in a wall, so I can kind of visualize what's going out. And then as I'm selling off, I can actually see them, you know, going reducing down. I think seeing it goes a long way in kind of telling your brain that, holy shit, you did buy too many, or you have too many. So for me, I'm selling these on StockX and GOAT just because that's what I can deal with. I can't deal with eBay listings and things like that and Facebook groups. It's just not for me. I don't want to talk to anyone or do any of that kind of stuff. Maybe in the future, but for this phase one, I'm just strictly going on what I can sell without having to talk to anyone. So after that, I basically put them in three piles. One was the overcut or match ask pile. And these are usually the sneakers that sell fast, like any Dunk, Foam Runner, Yeezy Slides, even stuff like brick that might be bricks, like 350s and stuff like that. You just have to look at the recent sales and you'll see how fast those sneakers are moving, and they're usually multiple sales per day. The other pile is the undercut pile, and these are the sneakers I gotta go. Yes, I'm publicly admitting to undercutting. Oftentimes these are slow sellers or just sneakers that I'm just never gonna wear. Yeah, or it might be price where, say, all the recent sales have been $400 on the apps, but the current asks are all $500. So, you know, go ahead. The market price really is $400. So you selling it to $499 isn't really going to move it. If you're patient and don't care how long you want to, you know, hold on to this shoe, go ahead. Match ask at $500. It might sell. Drop it to $499. It might sell. Or drop it to $450, $425 if, you know, the market price is really $400. I haven't done this in a while, but, you know, sometimes on a certain sneaker, you get into these undercut wars where you undercut by $1 and like a second later the other person does it, and then you might go, let me try this at 9 o'clock at night, and you undercut at 9 o'clock at night and they do it a second later. There's been times where, say, I woke up at 3 a.m. to go to the washroom and I'm like, well, screw that guy, I'm undercutting right now, and I've done that and woken up to sales. So it's a fun little war, and you can declare yourself the winner. The other stack is the I will lose $20 selling this shoe pile. And these are the sneakers where you got to let go of the sunk cost fallacy, where you have this tendency to kind of hold on to sneakers or bricks just because you got to get exactly the money that you put into it. Zions, of course, I always love making jokes about Zions every 2-3 months, is a perfect example of this. You could sell off all your Zions, lose $20 each, and be happy, or you could have a stack of them and be miserable that you have a stack of them. It really is the bus meme. Are you on the left side of the bus or the right side of the bus that's, you know, smiling and looking out the window? Then I do have like this one pile, which are like ultra bricks. These might be some random Converse that I thought would be a good idea to buy. I'm not even a Converse guy, so I don't know why I tried to get into Converse Chuck Taylors. And really, those are kind of, it take any reasonable bid over $50 pile for me. You know, if someone came to my door right now and offered me $100 for the whole pile, I'd probably take it. So, you know, going through my apps of what I've sold in the last like month or so, this is what I basically sold off. I've sold off a lot of these. I would buy almost every GR Jordan retro that came out. I don't know why. I just have this tendency just to pick them up. I sold off a bunch of Jordan 11s, the Concord Bred Lows, the Legend Blue 11 Lows, the IE Black Cement Lows. I don't even know why I bought those. Jordan 5 Stealth, that was the white one with the hints of blue. Or the Jordan 6 Electric Green is another one I sold off. for Yeezys, I mentioned the Zion. I found a couple of Zions that I had forgotten about that I thought I sold. And then I sold a couple of the quick movers, as I mentioned, some Yeezy slides and some foam runners. But I still have a few of those left, and maybe I'll get $20, $30 more in the spring. I sold some New Balance. I sold almost all the ALD 550s, and I just don't see myself wearing these. So I was like, out the door you go, and those are, you know, pretty quick sellers. And sure enough, you know, they'll probably go up in price. I might look at the apps later. You know, something I sold for $350 might be $450. But in this kind of stuff, I really don't look back and stuff and regret, because there's so many shoes that I've sold where I made way more than I should have. And it always balances out, is how I usually think about it. I sold off some Nikes, and I probably have to do a more evaluation on some of these. I can sell off a little bit more in this category. I had two pairs of skeleton Air Force Ones, the black one and the orange one, and I sold off those. I have a lot of SB Dunks, and so far I've only sold one of them. I sold FTC, the SB Dunk, which I mentioned on Twitter, totally looks like the cartoon characters in the One More Time Daft Punk video. So that's how I'm selling some of my collection off. I'm only going by this tier now. I will probably, you know, in a future podcast update where I'm at and how many more I've sold off. And I've never really used my profile to sell sneakers, and I don't think I will. I just don't feel the need to. I don't like handling DMs and sending tracking and having to worry about that kind of stuff. I like, you know, making $20 less or $50 less and having GOAT or StockX do it. That's just me personally. If you have more time and you're more invested in this kind of stuff, obviously do what's right for you and, you know, find these consignment shops and places like that that offer more payout. All right, that's enough podcasting for today. These are all a bunch of random topics that kind of connected in my head, and so I'm not sure if they did in the show itself. But in any case, this has been episode 26 of the Sock Jake Sneaker Podcast. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next time, and go fuck yourself.